IBEW and NECA for hosting us here today. It's a wonderful facility that you should be very, and I know you are very, very proud of, and proud of your industry and of your craft. And we thank you for permitting us to be here today and hosting us. I'd like to start out by having my committee introduce themselves and tell a little bit about their area and where they're from. We'll start with Representative Shields on my right.
Hi, my name is Chip Shields. I represent the area not far from here, inner north northeast Portland, and I've taken a tour out here before. I've worked in job placement for a long time, and I've seen firsthand the importance of having a good pipeline of trained workforce for living wage jobs, and I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
I'm Derek Kitts, represented from Hillsboro, Oregon, and I would like to agree with everything that Chip just said, so thanks for having us.
Mike Schaffler, District 48, Happy Valley, Southeast Portland.
You agree with me?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And I'm representing Alan
Brown. My house district is 10, Central Oregon Coast, Lincoln County, Western Lane County, and a little bit of Yamhill County and Polk County. And thank you again for having us here.
I'm Sal Escobar from District 6, which is basically Medford. I believe I have 17 constituents outside the city limits. So that's my rural constituents. So it's basically inside the city limits of Medford and the municipality of Medford.
George Gilman, District 55. I go just east of Sal, but I go then just a little bit further. I go to Lakeview and up to Prineville. It's all of Lake, Brook County, northern half of Klamath County, and about a third of Jackson County.
I'm Paul Holby. I'm from District 8, which is South Eugene, West Eugene, and South Central Lane County, and have a background in the trades and with apprenticeship programs, so I'm real happy to be here. And thank you to IBEW for hosting us.
Thank you, committee. And I'd like to start this morning with the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, Dan Gardner. Give us an overview, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I'd like to add my voice to thanking IBEW for hosting us here today. I actually have a slight affiliation with the organization. This is my home local, and I am third-generation electrician, so don't hold that against me, particularly the carpenters and the laborers. This morning, we're going to give you a little bit of an overview of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And with me is Annette Talbot, my deputy commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And basically, we're going to go through kind of the briefing book that we've dropped by most everybody's office, I believe, by now, that we tried to, by using that, consolidate a lot of different information about the Bureau that can be at your fingertips. Part of the first part is just simply the organizational chart, which shows you, you know, how the Bureau is set up. The basics of the three different divisions. There is the Apprenticeship and Training Division, the Civil Rights Division, and the Wage and Hour Division. We'll actually bring up each one of the committee administrators to talk about those particular areas themselves. I guess to give you a brief history, the Bureau is a little bit over 100 years old. The mission of the Bureau is within your briefing book, which is, you know, to promote and develop a highly skilled, competitive workforce in Oregon through partnership with government, labor, business, and education. We do that in a lot of ways through the Apprenticeship and Training Division. You actually, right now, this particular apprenticeship and training facility, which Ken Fry, the training director, will give you an overview of a little later. We were actually talking before the committee started about, you're really right in a corridor where there's a number of apprenticeship and training facilities. You have the sheet metal not very far from here, carpenters, the iron workers, the cement masons and bricklayers, and several others all right here within this metropolitan area right out here in East Multnomah County. We also are to promote the rights of workers, citizens, and with equal non-discriminatory treatment to encourage and enforce compliance with the laws relating to wages, hours, terms of condition of employment, and to advocate for policies that balance the demands of workplace and employers with protection of workers and their families. There's a couple of things through the commissioner's office I wanted to briefly touch on, which is the technical assistance unit for employers. For instance, we put on seminars and train human resources directors across the state through that unit, about 5,000 to 6,000 a year, and we answer over 25,000 phone calls every single year to employers answering their questions. The philosophy of the Bureau is simply that the best thing we can possibly do to avoid or to cure a problem is to avoid it in the first place through education and through that technical assistance unit. We do that. We also, it's an other funded unit. It's totally funded by either the seminars that they put on across the state or the booklets that we sell. These are the new, nice new ones, hot off the presses. We are actually going through a revamping. Some of them had not been updated since about 1998, and these are the new 2004 version, customer-friendly with nice tabs and everything else. but we are actually that unit does a tremendous lot of good work. Even when I was running for this office, I can remember going around the state and hearing different employers that I met with talk about the unit. One actually told me a great story. It was in Eastern Oregon where they talked about how a seminar had happened 3 or 4 weeks earlier. And when they went there, somebody was asking a bunch of questions about final wages and how you pay out when you lay off a worker, and started asking really poignant questions. And the training seminar director for our technical assistance unit answered all the questions. Suddenly that person said, well, I better go straighten up what I did a couple of days ago, and started to leave. And he said, wait a minute, here's who you call if you got any more questions. Here's saying, yeah, they really do try to avoid problems by straightening them out in the first place. We also, through the commissioner's office, have the hearings unit, which is you can choose in a case to go through the hearings unit. It is much less costly than going through the court systems where the commissioner does issue final orders on certain cases, and we do those throughout a period of time. And actually, with that, there's other things in your book from our performance measures, our budget, some of our legislative agenda. But I think at this time I'd rather bring up each one of the division heads and let them talk a little bit about their particular division. And we'll start with Wage and Hour. Christy Hammond's the director of the Wage and Hour Division.
Good morning.
Good morning, Christy.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, my name is Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division. And behind the Program Activities tab, you'll find information about the Wage and Hour Division that I'll be going over. The Wage and Hour Division has approximately 30 FTE and administers and enforces 7 major laws. The first of which I'm going to talk about is the child labor law. Our child labor unit issues approximately 5,000 employment certificates to the employers of minors each year. And that process consists of an employer submitting an application to our agency describing the duties that they would like to have minors employed by them perform. We review the employment certificate to make sure that the duties are allowable under the law, and if so, issue the employment certificate. If there's a problem with the duties proposed, we contact the employer and try to talk to them about what other duties they might be able to assign to a minor so that the employment is in compliance with the law. We also investigate reports of child labor violations. There are activities minors under the age of 18 may not perform, and occasionally we'll receive a report of a minor working on a roof or operating a forklift, and that's a priority for us to make sure that minor is employed safely. So we pretty much drop everything when we get a report like that and address that right away. Another program of ours is the Farm Forest Labor Contractor Program. We license 250 farm and forest labor contractors annually. We conduct investigations of reports of violations of farm and forest labor law provisions and collect unpaid wages for farm and forestry workers. We have a unit based in our Salem office of bilingual staff, and we have one staff person that also speaks Russian. We conduct outreach to the farm and forest labor communities enforce those laws. The prevailing wage rate law is a law that applies to public works construction projects. We conduct an annual construction industry survey and publish the rates that are required to be paid on public works projects. We investigate complaints of PWR violations. We conduct approximately 200 investigations annually. And we conduct statewide seminars for contractors and contracting agencies, informing them of the provisions of the law. And that's a program that is funded by fees paid by contractors who are on public works projects. They pay 0.1% of the contract price to the Bureau for our enforcement and public seminar program. We enforce the minimum wage, overtime, and working conditions provisions of the law. Working conditions are things such as rest and meal periods. We do receive quite a few complaints from workers in the state telling us that they're not receiving rest and meal periods, so we contact employers when we get those complaints and inform the employer that of the requirements and try to bring them in compliance. Most do comply after being contacted by us. The wage collection law is a law that applies if there is an agreement to pay a worker more than the minimum wage. So, for example, if an employer agrees to pay a rate of, say, $10 an hour and then fails to pay that rate of pay, the employee can file a wage claim with the agency and will enforce that wage agreement. Also under the wage collection law are final pay provisions and unlawful deduction provisions that we enforce. Part of the wage collection law is the Wage Security Fund, which is a fund that is available to pay workers when their employers go out of business and have insufficient assets to pay the final wages of their employees. And we can pay up to $4,000 of the last wages earned by employees. So that's a very valuable function for employees that otherwise would go without receiving their last paycheck besides being unemployed. That fund is funded by once a biennium diversion of 0.03% of the employment tax that is collected by employers. So that's a diversion for that fund. It's not an extra tax. Last year, we paid out over $1.8 million to more than 900 employees from the Wage Security Fund. And finally, we enforce the private employment agency law. Prior to 1997, we actually licensed private employment agencies, but the legislature abolished the licensing provisions in 1997. We still enforce the requirements that private employment agencies are required to comply with if they collect a fee from a job applicant. So there are certain provisions such as having a bona fide job order and providing accurate information to the job seeker that private employment agencies are required to comply with. There's also a section at the end of the section on wage and hour that show what our goals are. Our goals are to prioritize the issues that affect the lowest minimum wage earners. So we would like to resolve 80% of minimum wage and overtime claims within 45 days, process wage security fund claims within 30 days. We'd like to complete our prevailing wage rate investigations as quickly as possible, again, to get the money to the workers that have not been appropriately paid. and then we prioritize our handling of wage claims received from migrant and seasonal workers. So those are our goals. Any questions?
Thank you, Christy. Any questions? Representative Kitts.
I got a question. Of the complaints that you investigate, how many do you find to be fraudulent complaints or disgruntled workers just pointing a finger at an employer, making stuff up?
Representative Brown, Representative Kitts, I could probably get you a statistic because we code the closure codes on all the claims we enforce. Anecdotally, my impression is not a very high percentage. We do occasionally get a claim from a disgruntled employee. Usually it's not for unpaid wages. It's usually for other things. In fact, last week I got a phone call from an employee who was alleging there were rats in his employer's place of business and had a whole laundry list of things he wanted to complain about, and one was a child labor violation. And so sometimes that happens, but not so much with wage claims. More frequently is a situation where an employee may not be able to prove that they had an agreement, particularly with in the wage collection program where it's not a minimum wage claim. They'll say, I was promised a certain rate of pay. The employer will say, no, that wasn't the agreement. And if we can't prove that there was an agreement, we can't enforce it. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that does. Thank you. What are the ramifications of someone that is found to have fraudulently file a complaint with you folks?
Representative Kitts, none that I know of.
Thank you.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Yeah, I know I was involved in a prevailing wage claim, and we won after some very nice disgruntled laborer freaked out in the lunchroom and went up and yelled at the plant manager, and then we had a meeting at the hall, and magically it was solved. Anyway, On your performance measure goal 3C, it's talking about prevailing wage complaints. And the goal for your goal is quickly to resolve prevailing wage complaints quickly to protect both worker and public investment infrastructure. And your target's 55%. I imagine quickly just means a timely way so it doesn't drag out. But why is it, I'd imagine it's not fit at 55% now. And why is it so low? Why wouldn't we want to get that up? Explain why our target is so low.
Representative Brown, Representative Schaffler, that is fairly low. We would like to be able to conclude our prevailing wage rate investigations within 90 days. We are having difficulty concluding them that quickly for a variety of reasons. A lot of the complaints we receive, we have problems collecting records from the parties. We have problems with workers cooperating with us. Some of the complaints we get are not from the workers themselves, so we have to try to convince the workers to cooperate with us, sometimes while they're still employed. So those are just some of the reasons. But we are working with our staff to try to streamline how we conduct our investigations and work on speeding up those investigations.
Follow up.
And do you have a breakdown of prevailing wage complaints that separates union from non-union shops?
I'm sorry, Representative Schaffler.
Do you have a breakdown in numbers in prevailing wage, the source of prevailing wage complaints, union versus non-union shops?
Representative Schaffler, is the question whether the complainant is
yes.
a union or non-union
right.
complainant?
Do you have those numbers broken down somewhere?
No, we don't really track that information. We could provide a report of who the complainant is, and in some cases it's a union complaining. Otherwise, if it's a worker, we don't necessarily request information about their union affiliation or not.
Thank you.
Can you... there's a federal prevailing wage as well as a state prevailing wage. Does the Oregon labor and industry in any are you involved any with the implementing of the federal prevailing wage?
Well, Mr. Chair, the federal we work with the federal government. Sometimes we do our own independent on the commercial side, our own prevailing wage survey, the federal government does theirs. However, we don't do a residential survey. For instance, we use the federal rates for the residential side of things. And occasionally when there's something amiss, like, for instance, we had a complaint from the housing department that four of the rates within the federal rate were actually the commercial rate for that particular craft and not the residential rate. The wage and hour division looked into that. They found out it was true, established what the residential rate was, and we actually did send a letter to the federal government having them, you know, requesting that they lower those rates to the true residential rate, which is exactly what they did. So we do things like that with them. But there's various differences between the federal survey and our survey. For instance, we have 14 different regions across the state that are established by the employment department to follow the unemployment the employment department's regions. The federal government surveys each and every one of the 36 counties as a county individually. So we also survey a sampling of 1 week. They survey the entire year, all projects. So there are a lot of differences in how we go about our surveys.
Representative Brown, I'm sorry. One or the other law applies. Both state and federal law don't apply at the same time. So if there's a federally covered project that's subject to the Davis-Bacon law, the state prevailing wage rate law does not apply. And that's usually if there are federal funds in a project. So we don't cover those.
Okay, so the federal rate trumps the state rate then, wherever federal money's involved in
it. Absolutely.
Under the federal prevailing wage, there'd be 36 different wage. There could be 36 different wage rates for the same.
There potentially could be. I mean, there usually isn't, but there are 36 different regions that they survey for.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on that same line of questioning, what happens when you have a federal survey, like in the residential area, that actually comes out below our state minimum wage? Does BOLI intervene in that situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, absolutely. What has happened sometimes, the other thing I failed to mention about the difference between the federal survey, the state survey, as we survey every year, the federal government sometimes will go 10 years without a new survey, and they did for a while on the residential side, and the rates were so low that we had to increase them because it didn't meet the Oregon minimum wage standards. So they have to always comply with the Oregon minimum wage as well.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also along those same lines, do you ever run into any issues where the federal survey does not include classifications of work that the state federal surveys do? Does that ever crop up as a problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, it absolutely does. There are times that happens. We survey, you know, via classifications and a lot more classifications than the federal survey does. And actually, way back, there's actually a bill that will become before the committee that's a rather interesting one to get rid of the separate flagger issue. The federal survey didn't used to survey for flaggers. It has for a number of years, and that actually predates our own state survey, and that we actually survey for them now, too. It's an unused part of statute, but there are times when you had to put that in a statute because the federal government didn't and the state wished to do so.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Christy, for your testimony.
And while Amy Clare with the Civil Rights Division is coming here, I think the one thing to remind you about the Wage and Hour Division is that their mission and goal is really to get employers into compliance if they're out of compliance. Although we have a lot of fining capacities, we very rarely ever use them. For instance, if employers found in violation of illegal deduction from the paycheck or meal and rest period violation, or like, we send out a demand letter to them telling them that, you know, this is what we have a complaint for, here's what the law is, and really it's a goal to get them back into compliance. We don't really get into a fining structure or anything unless the person has the same violation for three times within a one-year period. So it's just something to remember about wage and hours. We absolutely try to work with companies to get them back in compliance.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and committee staff. For the record, my name is Amy Clare, and I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division. My short overview directly follows that by Christy in your book. I spilled water on mine, so probably have a better idea of what we do than I'm going to say. But the Civil Rights Division enforces laws prohibiting unlawful discrimination in employment, housing, public accommodation, and career schools. And public accommodation, those are places like retail establishments, your bus service, anywhere where the public congregates. We respond to approximately 27,000 inquiries each year. Inquiries are when we get phone calls, people asking about their rights. We also get hundreds of emails and probably several hundred walk-ins in our various offices every year. And those 27,000 inquiries translate into approximately 2,100 to 2,500, depending on the year, formal charges, complaints that are filed with us. And we have 14.5 FTE, 14 and a half investigators, that take on all of those complaints. And 98% of our complaints are in the area of employment. We get very few public accommodation cases and a handful of housing cases each year. And then the breakdown of the most frequent complaints you see are sex discrimination, and sex includes pregnancy-related issues, sex harassment, and gender. Disabilities, approximately 20%. Injured worker complaints are about 15%, and then race, color, national origin are about 10%. And in response to something that Representative Kitts had asked about the number of complaints you get versus what you really find an unlawful violation, in the instance of civil rights, our cause rate out of all those complaints is between 7 and 10%. And that's because a lot of discrimination that occurs or alleged discrimination is not unlawful discrimination. It's people behaving poorly in the workplace, people not getting along. We get calls where somebody's mad because somebody looked at them wrong. But really the burden is on the complainant to identify themselves as having being a member of a protected class or having been participating in a protected activity like whistleblowing. Then they have to show that there was a tangible harm, and then they have to show that that harm was related to the protected class. They have to have a link between those two. And that's a very tough burden to find. And so a lot of the times we spend our time trying to educate the people about what the laws are about and other areas where they can get assistance. Along those lines, I like to emphasize that we are a neutral law enforcement agency. A lot of folks think we're out to get employers, or people that call in think we're going to just dive into their workplace, but our job is to be objective, look at the facts, and then once we make a finding, then we do take a side and we try to settle the claim. And throughout the investigation process, we try to settle the claims, because the sooner that there's a decision made or sooner that they can work out, both parties are much happier rather than letting it drag on. By statute, we have 365 days to investigate a complaint. We have a goal of reaching that in 180 days, which is 6 months. And we also have some contract cases where the deadline is 90 days. We have a contract with Oregon OSHA to enforce their anti-discrimination laws for people who complain about workplace safety and health conditions. We also have contracts with some local, like the City of Portland, Multnomah County, City of Bend, City of Salem, City of Corvallis, and a couple other counties have local ordinances that go beyond state law, and they contract with us to do that enforcement. On the second page, talks about division goals, which I went over briefly, but we're really trying to improve our intake and investigative process. We've had in the agency, and I think the commissioner will probably talk about that more, we've lost about a third of our staff. So we kind of inherited that because this administration came in 2003. But we have fewer workers and just as much caseload or even more because the population is expanding. But despite that, we're really working to try to improve our computer system, to really respond to people's inquiries within 1 to 2 business days, if at all possible, and to try to get a quick decision on a case rather than letting it drag on. And then the last part of my tab here goes over all the protected classes, and it talks, you can see the ones that are covered under federal law and the ones that are covered under state law, and then there's the other miscellaneous protected classes that you may not be aware of. You may not be aware that in Oregon, if you use tobacco off hours, you cannot be discriminated against in employment. And if you have an expunged juvenile record, that can't be used against you either. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Kitts.
The governor has recently come out with backing a lot of these anti-discrimination bills, you know, dealing with sexual orientation, so on and so forth. Do you deal with any of those currently, even though they may not, you know, they may not be against the law per se to or whatever the case may be, but how many of those are related? I'm just wondering how big of a problem this is the governor is trying to address.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, as you know, sexual orientation per se is not covered under state law. There was a Tanner decision where under it we could narrowly take some cases by association. But when I was mentioning those local ordinances, the City of Portland, Multnomah County, I think there's some more listed here, those entities contract with us to do their investigations. And we average around 21 cases for the City of Portland and 21 cases for Multnomah County. We get 1 to 2 for Corvallis and Benton County, a handful here and there from Salem. I would estimate that between probably 40 and 80 total contract cases a year based on sexual orientation or gender identity. We do get, because there's sort of a patchwork of coverage for these laws, we get a lot of inquiries where we have to actually pick up a map and look to see if they're covered, because a lot of folks in Eastern Oregon, they won't have the same protections as people in the valley.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Schaffler.
So then, just kind of clear this up for me. If you're not in one of these communities and you're gay, you can be fired for being gay. That's legal? But you say they're not protected. Does that mean you can?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, that's basically correct.
Oh, that's nice.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony.
One thing, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to remember about the Civil Rights Division is that what we do through that process is provide a much less costly administrative process for settling disputes than it is to go through the court system. And that's our goal, and that is to try and bring things to resolution, whether there's a case, a cause case or not, to get it to conclusion as quickly as we can and as at least costly as possible.
Thank you, Representative Brown, members of the committee, committee staff. My name is Stephen Sims. I am the administrator for the State Apprenticeship and Training Division. I also serve as the secretary to the State Apprenticeship and Training Council, that is the actual statutory body responsible for carrying out the duties under ORS Chapter 660. Apprenticeship, I think most people know as a common term, refers to an experienced master teaching a trade or a skill to a younger person. Registered apprenticeship, which is what we do under ORS Chapter 660, is a bit more complicated than that. Registered apprenticeship deals with the combination of supervised on-the-job training, a journey person to a learner, an apprentice, in combination with theoretical classroom instruction. Part of registered apprenticeship is that apprentices must go to school. They must have theoretical instruction to back it up. That whole system is complemented by industry standards, industry training standards that are developed by professionals in the occupation. These are the skills and outcomes that we want to see, and the industry supervises that training. That whole package and program of training is put into a set of program standards that are submitted to the State Apprenticeship Council. The State Apprenticeship Council is then responsible for making sure that the local apprenticeship committees follow all of the laws, rules, and regulations governing registered apprenticeship. Right now, we have about 5,400 apprentices, active apprentices, registered in the state of Oregon. The construction season will be hitting its stride pretty soon. We'll see that number go up, hopefully. We currently have about 4,000 employers who are registered and approved to train apprentices in the state. Unfortunately, I think the last time we did a check, only about two-thirds of those employers were actually training apprentices. We have 152 different apprenticeship committees in the state of Oregon training apprentices in 44 different occupations. One of the requirements of the state and federal apprenticeship laws is that equal opportunity and employment be afforded to all Oregonians. Right now, minority participation in our apprenticeship programs is at about 13%, Female participation in our apprenticeship programs is at about 6%. Both of those numbers truly are substantially below the demographics for the workforce. We know that. We've been working with our committees, and I think most of the registered committees work very hard to address the EEO issue. One reason why we have such a small percentage of women in apprenticeable trades is in Oregon, about 75% of the registered apprenticeship programs are in the building and construction trades. We have another 20% in the industrial manufacturing trades and 5% in the service industry trades. But the bulk of our apprentices are in the construction trades. As you can see under the tab for apprenticeship on the first page under benefits of services, the specialty craft trades in the construction industries that rely on apprentices generated over $2 billion in payroll in 2002 and served over 7,500 employers. If you take the entire construction industry, just not the specialty crafts, but the entire construction industry, the industry generates over $3.2 billion in annual payroll. So it's obviously an important part of our economy, which we need to serve with qualified workers. The apprenticeship program in Oregon, we feel, is probably one of the best returns on investment the state makes as far as workforce. The average apprentice starting out, first-year apprentice, in their first year of employment, enters a program earning about $2,400 per month. That rises steadily as they increase through their program. Usually every 6 months they receive a step increase until they top out. But I don't know of many other state employment programs where you can start out earning $2,400 per month. The other reason why this is a great return on the state's investment is much of the infrastructure of apprenticeship is driven by private industry. Private industry funds the actual day-to-day operation of apprenticeship programs. The State Council and our office are responsible for making sure that the rules and regulations are followed, for providing technical assistance to the program, but training centers like this one, Commissioner Gardner just stated that there are about 7 or 8 training centers probably within a 3-mile radius of this building. That is the investment of the employers and the labor organizations into this training model. That investment has great outcomes for apprentices. They are learning a career occupation, but they're earning money at the same time. This is not go to school and not make money. They are actually earning income. As I stated earlier, the wages earned in the apprenticeable trades more than adequate family wages. So we provide real benefit for Oregonians. The other important thing is at the conclusion of the apprenticeship program, should someone complete the program, they receive a journey card. That journey card is the equivalent to a college diploma. They can take that journey card and move anywhere in the state, anywhere in the country, and go to work right away. So we feel we deliver a valuable credential to those individuals. The division itself, the Apprenticeship and Training Division, really has 3 broad functions. First of all, we work with industry to develop program standards, those training standards that I talked about earlier, and also a program for the administration of those standards. How will they keep their records? How will they select apprentices? And they put those into those program standards, and we register the program standards. Those program standards are important because they ensure uniformity. A carpenter in Portland is going to meet the same outcomes and qualifications as a carpenter in Medford, as a carpenter in Pendleton. We also register the apprentices. That's important so we can track them and make sure they get their journey card so they're credentialed at the end of the process. The second major function of the division is to conduct compliance. Again, making sure that our programs are following all the rules and regulations required by state and federal law. The compliance function is broken down into 2 aspects. Program operations. Are the students actually receiving education in the classroom? Is the education meaningful? Is the program keeping up to date and current with changes in the industry? The other aspect of compliance is EEO affirmative action compliance. We conduct EEO reviews on our programs annually. Every program receives a compliance review for EEO every year. We have backed off on our program operations reviews a little bit. We've been doing strenuous compliance for 5 or 6 years now. We feel the majority of our programs are in compliance. So basically, programs that have been in compliance for 2 consecutive years only receive a review once every 3 years. That was in response to complaints by some of our program operators that, gee, we spent less time in their books scrutinizing their books and more time giving them assistance, that they could do a better job. And that moves into the third element that the division works with, and that's facilitation, helping the programs operate their programs properly, providing them with technical assistance. The EEO oversight is important. If you've looked at our performance measures, we have a rather modest one for increasing our minority participation. We believe that modest goals are the best. We want achievable goals that we can reach. Once we establish a goal and meet it, we will then increase to a higher level. That is the same way we approach EEO compliance with our committees. The private program sponsors do a lot of work, outreach, recruitment with female and minority populations. This training center in particular has done a great job. They've hosted the Oregon Trades Women's Network Women in the Trades Fair now for a number of years. The Women in the Trades Fair this year is going to be held at the UA 290 Plumbers and Fitters Training Center in Tualatin on April 30th. It's probably the largest single recruitment activity targeted specifically at women in the states. The programs do try to meet their goals, and we certainly lean on them to try to help them in that regard. On the final page of the apprenticeship and training section, you'll see the division's goals, and the one I'd like to speak about a bit is the first one: organize a construction workforce task force in order to plan and train adequate numbers of workers to avoid projected shortages in the next decade. We currently are averaging about 1,100 new journey workers a year right now, people who actually graduate and complete their program. Of that 1,100, about 800 of them are construction workers. You'll hear a presentation a bit later this morning. If we're turning out 800 people a year, we're only turning out about 45% of what we need to do in order to make sure that we have an adequate construction industry workforce. Commissioner Gardner has stated that he'd like to start a dialogue with industry, with the legislature, with anyone who will listen about how we can get more contractors, more employers interested in training people through the apprenticeship system. I think that the rest of the presentation is laid out and is pretty self-explanatory, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
If a person goes through the apprenticeship program and becomes a journeyman, then his license or ticket or whatever it's called is recognizable by other states. Is that true?
Representative Brown, that is correct.
If they move to another state. What about persons that move to another country or people from another country that moves to this country? Do we recognize their training, or do they have to go through the system again? Or?
Representative Brown, in the licensed trades, those individuals would still be required to sit for a licensing examination coming from another country. As far as the recognition of journey level certificates for Oregonians or people who have completed any program in the United States going to another country, I think for the most part, with the exception of some countries in Europe, completion of a program in the United States is generally recognized as being of a journey level quality.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Thanks. That's right to that right there. Our program standards and apprenticeship program standards, what are they relative to the rest of the states? And then I glanced at your budget section, and I confess I haven't read your budget, but 2 years ago there was a lot of discussion about this money. Are you guys happy with the governor's proposed budget? Do you feel comfortable that will end up in the end? Those two questions, please.
Before I will defer to Commissioner Gardner on the budget issue. Let me answer your question about versus the other states. Mm-hmm. Let me first explain that there is a federal apprenticeship system. Any state that wants to operate an apprenticeship program has to ask permission from the United States Department of Labor to operate its own program. 26 states have chosen to do so. The remaining states have federal programs. In the federal system, I think that based upon my discussion with my counterparts in states that do have their own state apprenticeship councils, we do a substantially better job. I think that there is evidence on record, and in fact, the General Accounting Office is currently doing an investigation of the federal apprenticeship program because they failed to require programs to adhere to the standards that they've submitted and sent in for approval. So I think certainly we do a better job than the federal system. With respect to other states, particularly the larger states, there's a competition as to who can do a better job. I'm happy to say that I think that among the states that run their own state apprenticeship councils, we have some of the best trained people in the country. And the simple reason for that is I think that our sponsors, our employer groups and our employee groups, invest more money in apprenticeship. They take hold of it. They build their training centers. They educate their instructors. They're actually willing to listen to our office or to some of our counterparts when they say, you could improve here, you can do this better. So I would stack Oregon-based apprenticeship programs against any program in the country.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, as in regards to the budget, I think the biggest thing to remember about the Bureau of Labor and Industries is that over the last decade, as other agencies were growing, the Bureau has been reduced over 33% in its staff since its high of 159 employees in the 93-95 biennium to 106 today. Also, there's been closure of a full-service office in Pendleton, in Bend, the total closure of the Coos Bay office. We are a very efficient agency. In regards to the governor's budget, one thing I did do between last biennium and this biennium was to try to find further efficiencies. My belief is that I wanted to reduce infrastructure and not people. And if there was any way we could find to be more efficient, we did a number of things, like, for instance, in the Portland office where we occupied all but a little sliver of the 10th floor and a quarter of the 11th floor, and we had four reception areas, one for each one of the divisions and one for the commissioner's office. I looked at that. The governor's office gave up the little sliver of the 10th floor, and we consolidated down to one reception area, moved everyone down from the 11th floor to the 10th floor, reducing our square footage of floor space and reducing the rent by over $10,000 a month. We also turned back a number of cars, including the commissioner's car. I actually don't drive a state car. I drive my own car. It's much easier. It's much more efficient for me. And we've turned back a number of those as well. And through those efficiencies, it's about we turned back close to $250,000 to this biennial budget through those types of efficiencies. That's what the governor accepted as a cut in his budget. Other than that, he recommended full funding for the agency. And, you know, I think that we do a lot more with less at a time when we have over 247 more people over that same 10-year period joining the workforce, which greatly adds to our caseload. And it also adds, you know, when the legislature passes legislation every single session, adding to our caseload as well. I think we do a very I'm very proud of the agency. I'm proud of the employees that work there and the job that they do under the strain that they do. And I think the governor's budget would be perfectly adequate. Thank you.
Stephen, how difficult is it for a young person to get into an apprenticeship program?
Chairman Brown, I hate to say it. I think it's extremely difficult. I think there are a number of reasons for that. And this is not just my conclusion. This is from talking with our program operators. Probably one of the biggest issues is that there is a gap between what's going on at our elementary and secondary schools about preparing people for careers and opportunities in the building and construction and the manufacturing trades. And it's not even a matter of not preparing them for that. Some of them don't even know what the different trades are. A few years ago when I was a field representative with the division, I used to go out and do promotional tours and try to drum up interest in the high schools. And I asked a group of students if they knew what a sheet metal worker did. And there was one student only. We don't even teach them the value of these trades. So why do we even get to teaching them the nuts and bolts, the competencies that they need to get into them? That's the first reason why I think that there's a difficulty in making that transition. The second reason is that, quite frankly, the trades don't want people who just have a high school diploma. They want people who have the ability to do math. They want people who have initiative. And it's hard to find those people for physical trades when they can say, well, I might make less money working in high tech, but I'll be inside and I'll have a 401k that may or may not disappear. They don't necessarily want to investigate, could this be an opportunity for me? I'd have to say the single largest complaint we get from our employers and from our program sponsors is the difficulty in getting people who are ready to enter into the trades. I think that we are trying to do some innovative things with the Department of Education and some local ESDs to try to integrate some vocational technical education into the high school level, but the level we're working on right now is small. Until we can get a groundswell to say these jobs are vital, they are valuable, it's going to be an uphill battle having young people prepared when they leave high school being able to enter into an apprenticeship program.
My own experience in my Lincoln County as a countywide school district, and when my kids were in high school there, they had a number of vocational programs there, and they're all gone today. And I tried very hard to keep some of those there, and I got a lot of pushback from the administration there that they were too expensive and they were not going to maintain those programs, that they had other places to go with their money. And I can appreciate that, but I think that they're writing off a great number of young people at that level of education just because they focus so intently on sending kids on to universities and forgetting the other kids, which are probably the largest part of the school population that will go out in the workforce and needs to have this understanding that and knowledge that there is, you know, there is some vocational skills out there that are very good jobs and very good careers, and they need to tweak that interest at that level. And I don't know, maybe you people have some suggestions on how us as legislators we can open some of those doors to those people, but that certainly needs to be done.
Well, Mr. Chair, I couldn't agree with you more, actually, that there are a couple of initiatives that we are working on at the Bureau. One thing over the last several years is we've seen particularly manufacturing leave our state as well as the United States. You see a lot more concentration on pushing students to college, and you'll see a lot more guidance counselors and the like pushing toward college, when we all know there are a number of people out there going through high school that they're more geared toward working with their hands and working with the trades. And one of the initiatives we're working on with the Department of Education is that guidance counselors in the schools go through a recertification process every single year, just as licensed crafts do in doing their re-education. We're looking at trying to put together a program for those guidance counselors to tour them through different training facilities to show them the math, the science, the wages, hours, and the working conditions, so we can really help to work with those guidance counselors that they would be more advocates for the industry, helping to send more of the best and the brightest students into the trades, rather than looking at it as some diminished career that, you know, if you aren't going to go to college, maybe you can sort of do it, but realizing that it actually is a meaningful, skilled career. One other initiative, you mentioned, the shutdown of all those trade programs, and that's very true. In the budget shortfall of the education system across the state, one of the first things that seems to be cut is shop classes, voc tech, vocational training. One of the initiatives we're starting to start, we've been working on it for a while now, is to try and match up those, you know, we mentioned there's 54 different training facilities like this one around the state. Actually, this is probably one of the largest and most expensive you'll see. Most of them are, you know, there's a couple that are just about the same size, but most of them are a little smaller. But those, most programs, this is not one of them, but most of them have facilities where they're open, where there's no students going through it during the day. And we're looking at trying a couple of pilot projects, one in a rural setting, one in an urban setting, where perhaps we can work with the school district to target students that might be geared toward the trades, to bring them into those training facilities, to recreate some of those vocational and technical training classes for at least a limited number of students to get them exposure and access to the crafts and to be able to let them know what that kind of a career is like.
I agree. Representative Escobar.
Yes. Have we embarked upon a program? Maybe we need to make that policy as legislators, but to cooperatively work with school districts, high schools, and do a vocational skill center where we can promote vocations within the high school and have a seamless transition into the apprenticeship programs. Have we pursued that at all? Because I know that we're in a dilemma in 549C in Southern Oregon, and we have two high schools that are just about maxed out. So we have to come up with a third high school. Now the question is, what kind of a high school would we like to have? Would we like to have one similar to what we have today with the two existing high schools, or should we have a trades vocational skill center? And that is a talk right now, whether we should do that. And I would be inclined more to go with the skill center, because when I went to school, which is back in the old days when we had covered wagons, but we had vocational training in school. The sad part about it is even today, 549C, they've dropped off a lot of those, but they still provide pool and PE. And I'm not talking about swimming pool. I'm talking about billiards. But I guess that's vocational as well. I'm not sure. But anyway, have we worked diligently and aggressively with school districts to see if we could promote? Because you're probably talking 40-60% of the population will end up in a skilled labor. And personally, I'd rather be a plumber than a neurosurgeon. You have a lot less time to have to work, and you make a lot more money.
I prefer you to be, too.
Chair Brown, basketball. Your question is, have we worked diligently? I think we've worked the issue. I guess diligence is a matter of opinion, but I do think we've worked the issue. I think we need to work it harder. I think that one thing that we are seeing is we have to be able to accept what education is willing to give us right now, and that's why we're thinking about two small pilot projects to start. If we can show them that this can be successful, if we can show them it can be done, maybe they will embrace the concept. Representative Escobar, in your district, including the apprenticeship training center on the community college campus, there are three training centers in your district. I believe they all train in the evening. They are vacant during the day. Your example, do we have an alternative way to get these people trained? That's the kind of innovative discussion that needs to be had with those training center operators. Can we do some instruction here? Can we use your curriculum and articulate it with the high school curriculum and begin to move those people on? I think that's what diligent means, getting to that conversation and seeing if we can make some progress, and that's certainly our goal.
Representative Holdy.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Steve, when you were talking about these community colleges and trying to branch out into the school districts, and I've spent a little bit of time doing that myself, trying to branch out, working with a carpenter's apprenticeship program down in my area. And I know that most apprenticeship programs that we're speaking of as are funded through employer and employee trust funds that contribute and fund these apprenticeship programs. There are programs out there that are through the community colleges, as you've recognized. And how does the funding mechanism work for those? Is that a parity situation where the people that participate in those programs are being funded privately as well? Do their tuitions get paid by those same employer-employee type of situations? Or is the state paying for those types of programs?
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, It's a changing field out there right now with respect to the relationship between community colleges and apprenticeship committees. At one time, you had the majority of apprenticeship programs that were able to build their own training centers and pay for their own instructors and foot the bill themselves. They were able to go to the community colleges in their district and say, I'm doing an educational mission which matches up with yours. Can you reimburse me for part of what I'm doing? And they would enter into a contract to reimburse these individuals because the community college recognizes a journey level certificate for up to, I believe, 33% of your credit to an associate's degree. And at one time, the community colleges were happy to do that. A few years ago, the community colleges began to pull back on that agreement. At the same time, you had other apprenticeship programs that did not have their own training centers, did not have their own instructors. They basically went to the community college and said, develop, design, and run a program for me. Those apprentices, in most cases, the apprentices paid their own tuition, the community college provided the services, and that was it. So I think Representative Holvey, in getting at your question, was that to some degree a subsidy of those programs? I think, yes, it probably was. The unfortunate thing that's what's happening now with the FTE cap, the community college level, and the shrinking value of FTE, both of those parties are getting hurt right now. We have more and more colleges saying, we cannot reimburse you, private training center, for the services that you provide. We don't have the money, so keep doing it on your own. There'll be no state support for your mission. And we're having programs that have traditionally relied solely upon the community college for support saying, you know what, you only run 15 to 20 apprentices through here a year. We can use our FTE better. We won't be offering you services. So we have those programs, and many of those programs are now in rural parts of the state. And they're in a bind. Where do they get their education? So I think it's a changing landscape. I think the community colleges are trying to use their best judgment about how to apply their dollars, but it certainly leaves people who use the apprenticeship system in a bind, either to reimburse those who provide their own services or just to make sure that they can continue minimal services. So I think 5 years ago I would have said, yes, we are in a subsidy situation, but it's so fluid right now that I don't think that still exists. I think everyone who operates in an apprenticeship program is trying to figure out a way to keep their program funded to the extent that there are public dollars available to help. And I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Follow up, Mr. Brown. Thank you, Chair Brown. Well, I guess what I was getting at is that we have programs out there that are obviously getting state subsidy dollars, and a lot of programs out there that are privately funded, and it seems like we're setting up a system of unequal participation economically into training. And of course the programs that don't pay for their own to the extent that others do have a huge advantage out there in the marketplace because the state is subsidizing their programs to a certain degree. And you know, I would hope that, you know, we would be able to find some sort of parity in that issue, because I think that's one of the issues that we face, that if we could solve that issue, we would be able to have these training facilities available to the wider spectrum of the communities in regards to public education, cooperating, and trying to figure out that parity issue. And I know that's probably going a little bit beyond your scope, but I think your agency really has to be involved in that discussion to really make these apprenticeship programs available to the school districts.
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, I think phrased that way, we agree that those employers and employee groups that fund their own programs, the ones that Commissioner Gardner mentioned out here, the Area 1 inside electrical programs, those programs definitely are at a competitive disadvantage when to other programs that can just walk up and say, we'll pay tuition if you run a program for us. And what we need to do is find the right balance so that we can offer programs in every single county in the state.
Well, and one thing, if I could add it, Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, one thing to remember is that there are a number of programs. I'm sure Ken will outline it a little bit better, but like this particular program, the only thing a student pays for is their own books. They actually get, I couldn't give you an exact figure, I'm sure Ken could, but over a five-year period, about $15,000 worth of basically free education that is paid for jointly by the union and by the electrical contractors through a trust fund. There are a number of programs out there, however, that do charge the student, use a combination of community college dollars, and that's the major source of their funding where the industry doesn't contribute as much into the fund as they do. The student actually pays for most of the education themselves, combined with some state dollars and a small contribution from contractors.
Thank you, Stephen, for your testimony. It's a very interesting conversation we've been having here.
Well, Mr. Chair, one last thing is simply that in the back of your folders, if you have them, is a newer brochure that we come up. Just kind of helps to tell people about the agency. It does give a great brief overview, and, you know, for any of you who have town hall meetings alike, we'd be happy to provide as many copies of that as we could and any information that we can provide to you.
Thank you, Commissioner, for the overview this morning. We really appreciate it. Could we have Art Ayers, please? Good morning, Art.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee and staff. My name is Art Ayer, State Employment Economist with the Oregon Employment Department. And as I understand it, I was invited to give you a brief overview of the construction industry in Oregon. And I believe you have in your packets a handout, what we call our labor market information handouts. It has a header that says labor market information on it. And I also brought, and I believe you have, a graph that shows the total employment in Oregon's construction industry starting with 1990 and running through the projection that goes out to 2011. That graph, and just make the point that there is expected to be considerable employment growth in construction in Oregon over the next seven or so years. We're currently 2004 data, that's our most recent estimate. So going forward from 2005, those are all projections, and those come from the most recent state economist quarterly forecast. That's the March 2005 forecast that's put out by the Office of Economic Analysis in the Department of Administrative Services. That forecast shows growth of about 17,000 jobs between 2004 and 2011 in the construction industry in Oregon. And you might notice that over the last 7 years, from 1997 to about to 2004, we've had virtually no gain in employment in the construction industry. So there has been a considerable amount of time passed, partially because of the major recession that we recently had, that we have not had any significant growth in construction. Now, just over the last year, we have had pretty significant growth, and indeed, with our January numbers, our seasonally adjusted construction employment figure reached a new peak. So that's something that indicates some growth right there. And you can see, of course, between 2003 and 2004, pretty substantial gain in employment on the graph. So my point there is simply that there is expected to be considerable employment growth in the construction industry over the next 7 years out through 2011. Now, of course, a forecast cannot be guaranteed. There have been forecasts before that weren't right on the money, but this is the most recent information that's available, and, of course, state government bases its budget partly on numbers such as these. So that's the first point I'd like to make. The second point I'd like to make is to call your attention to that handout entitled Employment Projections for Apprentice-Based Occupations. And this is a a handout that my coworker Brenda Turner put together. She's not able to be with us today, but if you have questions that I can't answer, I'll certainly try to get back with her or with our other occupational economist and get an answer for you. The points that I'd like to make relating to the employment projections for apprentice-based occupations is that our current workforce in the construction industry is a little bit older than, well, I shouldn't say that. Actually, it's a little bit younger than the average workforce. But over the next 10 years, we expect about two-thirds of the people currently 45 and older in the construction workforce to leave that construction workforce. And that's just based on the structure of the age groupings that you see in the pie chart on the first page of that handout. With additional growth in that industry, the actual number leaving may be slightly smaller. Now, one thing that we do every 2 years is we do a 10-year projection of employment in the state of Oregon, both by industry and by occupation. And there are three tables attached to this handout or accompanying this handout that show some of our occupational projection data. Those projections go from 2002 to 2012. Those are our most current projections at this point. We will be updating those to the 2004 to 2014 period a little bit later this year. Table number three, the last table in the handout, focuses on construction-related apprenticeable occupations, and actually the top 10 largest construction-related apprenticeable occupations. And it shows that there were about 66,000 jobs in those occupations in 2002, and there is expected to be considerable growth in those 10 over this current 10-year period. An average of about 775 new jobs per year due solely to growth, overall growth in that set of occupations. And also there are additional openings in occupations due to people leaving an occupation. It could be retirement, it could be changing to a different occupation, and of course death and disability are also part of that reason for leaving. The number of openings expected on an annual basis, every year during this 10-year period is a little bit over 1,200. So when you add those together, you get almost 2,000 openings expected per year for those 10 construction-related apprenticeable occupations. On that same table, we show the 2002 completers of apprenticeship programs in Oregon in those occupations, totaling about 766 completers for 2002. So the highlighted column at the end, the highlighted column title, shows the difference between the expected annual openings, and of course that's not expected that every single year we'll have that number, but on average over that 10-year period, that's what we're expecting, the difference between those annual openings and the most recent figure we had for completers in apprenticeship programs in those occupations. Now it is possible that our projected replacement openings, these are openings due to people leaving the occupation for a variety of reasons, could be a little bit low. And one of the reasons for that is that we come out with our projections rather early in the federal cycle of doing these projections. And in doing so, we wind up using somewhat older, what are called occupational change factors at the federal level. We obtain occupational change factors from the federal government. And so our figures actually would be reflecting a slightly younger workforce at the federal level. Our occupational change factors are reflecting a somewhat younger workforce than is actually the case. So we may actually have a bit more in the way of replacement openings than shows up on these graphs or on these tables. I think that's really the main points I wanted to make. Yes, I believe that's it. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Any questions, Matt? Don't see any. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
So the next one is... Okay, committee, I'm going to, our next is to open a public hearing on House Bill 3097, Janet, can you give us an overview of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3097, there was, we put a copy of the bill at your place if you didn't have bill folders this morning. House Bill 3097 was introduced by this committee, and it's at the request of the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council, the National Electrical Contractors Association, the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association. And it would eliminate the 2006 sunset date on DCBS's authority to study and implement a program for electronic access to building codes information. The 2003 legislature allowed the department to identify resources and to develop a network to provide electronic access to building codes information, including exploration of resource sharing agreements with private businesses, and to develop a pilot program in the Tri-County area. This followed the 1999 legislature's establishment of a Tri-County Building Industry Services Board that set up a center to provide contractors and building officials in the 27 jurisdiction Tri-County area to, again, make consistent and standardized building code inspections in that area. This bill would expand that authority and take off the sunset date. It would expand their authority to move this program statewide. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. First, could I have Mark Long, please? Thank you, Mark. I realize you had preferred that we hold this committee hearing down on the, at Cloverdale, on, close to the Nahalem River and the Mistucket River, so you could do some steelhead fishing, but
for that,
couldn't
Mr.
arrange
Chair.
It today.
Well, Mr. Chair, for the record, Mark Long, and I'd be happy to provide that field trip for this committee. We have a few other bills in our system to talk about, and we could do that. I'll be there tomorrow and let you know how it goes next week.
Are you entertaining a motion, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am very pleased to be here to talk about this bill. Three fish or 3 minutes. To talk about this bill addressing e-permitting. I'm passing out a background flyer just that talks about the bill, and I'm also passing out just a copy of one of the innovative things that we've done here over the last year that I want to share with you, these minor label permits. So, and I've reminded staff that I do need to get these back. These are legal documents, and my staff will have my hide if I don't show up with these documents.
And you'll notice, Mark, I'm the only one that didn't get one. They don't trust me.
Well, you can see that they don't trust me because we have to have a special courier here with me to make sure that they do get returned back to the office. So, nevertheless, House Bill 3097 is the really next step in the pilot that we worked on. And our backgrounder document kind of talks about it. And what I'd just like to share with the committee, in Oregon, there are 130 different jurisdictions that are selling building permits. That activity supports a $5.5 billion overall impact to the construction economy. It's been communicated to me that we need to provide consistency, we need to provide clarity, we need to speed up the process of getting permits. And this is an effort that we worked with the trades last year on. House Bill 3097 improves that and allows it to be expanded statewide. On the back of my flyer, it really talks about the program, and here's where we're at. We started last year scoping out the program, figuring out what we could get done within existing resources, finding out what it would take to do a statewide system, seeking federal funding to support this effort, and we set out a path to develop a pilot in the Tri-County area as the previous legislation allowed us to do. I'm pleased to let you know that the first part of that pilot is this minor label system where you can buy these permits
that we sell now at the state of Oregon through an online web-based application. We have to mail them out to you, but we get them to you within 48 hours. These permits, they're plumbing and electrical, are usable anywhere in the state. I think this is the future to try to speed up the process and make it easier for folks to comply with the permitting requirements. Contractors buy these in bulks of 10 online from us. We get them out to us, and whether they're doing work here in the Portland area or down in the Medford area or wherever, they can use these permits. They have them in their hand. They don't have to wait in line, and they put the permits on the work site, and then we inspect them through a quality control process after the fact in partnership with the state and local government. That was the first step. The second step of our project during this last interim was to develop an address locator system for folks doing work in the metro area. Believe it or not, trying to figure out which jurisdiction where you're supposed to buy the permit is actually a big deal. It's quite complicated, and there are, I hear stories almost weekly about a contractor who thought he was in one area, ended up being in a different area. Now he's subject to refunds and fines from competing jurisdictions, and all he's trying to do is get a permit. And so what we've done is put together an address locator with six partnering jurisdictions where you go in, you type in your address, it tells you where you're at, you can download their forms, it tells you the jurisdiction, you get their permit information, and then by the end of this next month, they'll be able to apply for over-the-counter permits, pay for those permits online through a state website, get authorization to work, and request their inspections 24/7. And we think that that's the future for consistency, speed, trying to break down some of the barriers that occur between knowing which jurisdiction, what do I need, how do I get it, standing in line, and all those kinds of things. This bill helps us not only keep the pilot going in the Tri-County area, but allows us to offer this service on a statewide basis. We've heard from jurisdictions in the Mid-Willamette Valley. I hope to work in Representative Esquivel's area, because we have a lot of different jurisdictions down in that Jackson County, Josephine County, Representative Gilman as well, to allow this pilot to work down there. We think it's a good bill and should pass, and we think that the future, and you can see, you know, I'm in phase three here. This bill allows me to continue the first three phases, expand it on a statewide basis, and then our ultimate goal would be to have one state permit system that would allow for electronic plan submittal, permitting information that other jurisdictions would then buy license into. It doesn't make sense to me for each jurisdiction 100 times over in the state to spend the money on permit and permit software systems when the state could provide one and then they could license into it and it all would be consistent. So that's what we're working on. These are our goals. We need your help to continue the pilot. I really appreciate the industry support of this effort. As you can tell, I'm very proud of this effort. This is a big piece of what we're doing at Building Codes, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you have.
What kind of pushback do you get from counties and cities? Are they like this? Or?
Mr. Chair, the jurisdictions that are participating are doing it. This is a voluntary permissive bill. It does not mandate that these jurisdictions provide these services. So the six pilot jurisdictions stepped up to the plate, provided their resources to integrate with our resources, and assuming success, which we think it will be when we turn the switch on, you have to be careful about these things, we anticipate many other jurisdictions wanting to plug into our system. So, you know, there might be some pushback, might be some trepidation from some of the jurisdictions, but when you see that it works, that the customer service aspects of it make their job easier, and then on the overall goals of one system where they don't have to run separate IT shops and worry about all this, they just plug into a system that's already there as long as it integrates with their existing financial and tracking systems and planning systems, which is important, I don't see a lot of pushback on that. It seems to make sense.
Representative Esquivel.
So when we plug into the system, we get online, we do ourselves a permit here, the monies that are deposited into that account for the permit basis, it'll go to the specific jurisdiction, and it depends upon each jurisdiction, of course, has a different, there's no rhyme or rhythm why each one of them have a different permit value, but each one of them has that. So it'll automatically go into that jurisdiction.
Chair Brown, Representative Esquivel, that's correct. Under our pilot, under this first portal, you log into a state system. We're providing the backbone, if you will, or the access point.
The structure point.
Yep. You go into that. You put in your address. Right now, under the pilot, if it's one of the six participating jurisdictions, the address locator comes up. If it's 1234 Main Street, says, oh, you're in Beaverton or you're in Portland, you click on it, and then it lists the standardized permits that are available. It's electrical, plumbing, and mechanical right now. You select the permit. Then their fee pops up for that jurisdiction. You put in your Visa card. It's deposited in their account. There's no pass-through through the state at all. It goes directly into the local government's bank account, and then you request the inspection. You print off a receipt, and you go do your work. It's that simple.
Representative Schaffler.
You know, this is just great government, and this is going to add to accuracy and save money and time and frustration. And I have been involved in just very simple permits for very simple projects and had just felt like I wanted to pull my hair out. And I can imagine what it would be like building an Intel and having it. But you know what? I'll tell you, this is good stuff. This is good government. And if anybody pushes you back, you should just go out there and run them over to get this stuff.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Representative Schaffler. Better than being run over, I suppose.
Thank you, Mark, for your testimony. Is there any other? Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, this looks pretty neat. I'm kind of curious of how this goes forward with the process of you know, plan review and submitting plans and, you know, because sometimes I think permits have been based on the value of work and getting into other types of work besides plumbing and electrical. I'm just wondering, you know, how that system is. Are you working on that as far as that goes, and it will it get expanded to where people are submitting plans to the state instead of the local agency, or is it, I mean, how is that going to work?
Chair Brown, Representative Holley, I'm going to kind of answer your questions a couple different ways. First of all, in the plan review, just to share information, whether it's electronic or not, okay, under current law, and it's some things we worked on this last session. First of all, if it is a large industrial project that is traded sector or part of the governor's shovel-ready certified sites or important to the economic well-being of the state, you can come to the state to make sure your project gets through on a timely manner. That's some of the tools in our tool chest that we received this last session. We think that supports the overall economic goals. So that's there existing. We also have master plan design capacity, where if you're a builder and you wanted to do the same type of project in more than one area, you can come to us and we'll approve that, and you don't have to go through the process. That's still under the manual system, you know, the old architecture, if you will. Under our plans, where we're at with this pilot is we're at the capacity of my funding level as far as being able to do this web-based portal. And then I've got the infrastructure set up now. This bill is going to allow the other jurisdictions in the rest of the state and Tri-County to plug into it. We're okay there. Steps 4 and 5 on the back of my document really talk about electronic plan submittal and statewide permitting. The technology's there. We need to get the funding. During our study 2 years ago, we determined it would be $10 to $15 million. We're currently seeking federal funding to support a pilot on that, and we're currently in discussions with other jurisdictions on how we might partner to do that. So it's there. We don't have the infrastructure or the programming or anything other around the study of it, but we know that we can do it. We know the technology. It's just relationships and dollars at this point. So that's the future work. This bill allows me to continue to study it, seek federal funding, work with the governor's office to have this as part of the priority for Oregon's delegation, and to continue that big goal that I have of the one system that will allow electronic plans and all that, as well as keep this pilot going in the metro area and then expand it on a statewide basis. So that's kind of where we're at.
Thank you, Mark. I want to echo what Representative Schaffler said. This is really, truly good government. I want to commend you for the efforts that you put into making it happen.
I appreciate that, again. Mr. Chair. Again, this is something we're extremely excited about, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you. Jared Broadfoot, please. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot with PacWest Communications, representing all of those folks at the top of this bill, so I will spare you the five-minute dissertation on who we represent because it's printed on the bill. Mark did an excellent job explaining what this bill does and how we're continuing the efforts of past sessions. Bottom line, this bill helps contractors and it helps construction in this state. This is common sense legislation that we should run through the building and make sure the governor puts his signature on as soon as possible. Some of the problems that contractors, as Mark has explained, and I'll explain a little bit further, run into is they don't know what jurisdiction they're in. Obviously, that seems pretty silly. And recently, I found out that personally, trying to find out what county I lived in was pretty difficult as well. So where you register to vote, where you get certain permits. So contractors run into the same problems. The other problem is you can't pull a permit in a timely manner, or you have to drive hundreds of miles to pull that permit. That seems silly. And this pilot project and now continuing it on a statewide basis will allow us to get past those problems that contractors have to run into. As Mark said, this is a long-term project. It's going to cost us some money, but this legislation will allow us to continue down this path and make sure that this is a priority for the state, as it's certainly a priority for the contractors and for the trades. I did also want to mention and thank you folks for coming to the NECA IBW Training Center. I know there was a couple thank yous to IBW, but this is a NECA IBW Training Center, and I tell you what, labor management worked very hard to spend their own money on this facility to make sure that they train quality folks for the future of the trade. So with that, I won't spend much more time, and I'll let Stan kind of elaborate on his experiences as a contractor and some of the things that I have mentioned in just passing what he's actually run into.
Chairman Brown, representatives, my name is Stan Heil. I'm with Heil Electric in Portland. I'm a NECA contractor. I'm also the chairman of the Legislative Committee for the State of Oregon for NECA. And I want to welcome you here. This is a building that we do as electrical contractors, some of our best work, the education and the continuing education of our workforce. In regards to the e-permitting thing, it's an issue that we've combated for years and years and years about confusion over not only where to take a permit, when to take a permit. These have been big issues for us as contractors, as business people that have added unnecessary cost and expense to just operations in the state of Oregon. We're all very much involved in licensing and compliance, and we think that e-permitting would not only tie the state together but offer great efficiencies for the state and for business people in the state.
Any questions, committee? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Can I have Commissioner Gardner again, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. To give you a little bit of brief history that your committee administrator didn't address eons ago when I was a freshman legislator in the 1997 session, I introduced legislation to create a task force to look into the creation of a tri-county service center. Actually, back then, I was a service electrician, actually working for Brian Christopher, who's in the audience, although he doesn't often admit that that's the true story. But, we really did have situations where on minor label permits, each county would issue their own minor label permits, where they would have actually be only good for 6 months. You'd have in several service trucks, if you worked across several different counties, different minor labels going bad in the truck. And the idea was to bring Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas County together in a uniform system on minor labels, on applications for permits. It seemed to me not only for a contractor, but also as an individual. If you lived in Gresham and worked in the city of Portland, why couldn't you simply, on your lunch break, go apply for a permit at the city of Portland to build a garage on your property in Gresham? And that was the original concept. That's why it was started up. I love to see the Tri-County Service Center continue to grow and expand and get to the electronic state. And I hope they continue to do so because I think it's great for the economy. I think it's great for consumers, and it's great for the businesses out there as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. And we have no one else here to signed up to testify. And committee, it's my intention that we will work this bill and send it on its way on Wednesday meeting in the Capitol next week. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3097. And we will have Ken Fry and some other people from the training center here to give us some information on the training programs here.
Chair Brown, committee members, if I may, Steve Sims, the administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division. We were going to have a short panel presentation on some of the various training centers, what they do, the challenges that face them, and we had three training directors lined up. Unfortunately, one of them has got a plane that they need to leave to catch in about 9 minutes. So I'm wondering if it'd be possible to have John Steffens from the Willamette Carpentry Training Center come up first just to tell you a little bit about his organization, and then we'll have Mr. Fry and Mr. Coolmore come up.
Please do.
Thank you.
I can hear the engines running out the end of the runway.
Good morning, Chair Brown, committee members, committee staff. I'm John Steffens. I'm the training director for the Willamette Carpenters Training Center. We cover the area of Oregon, Southwest Washington, Southern Idaho. Today I want to talk a little bit more about, instead of our training center, what we feel in the future for Oregon and the needs that's going to take place. You heard earlier that the current workers' average mean age in the state of Oregon is about 46, 47. The next 10 years, there's a great opportunity for all those folks to retire. With that, there is going to be a shortage of skilled workers in the state of Oregon. Apprenticeship, as well as, you know, the state of Oregon, it's our responsibility to make sure we have skilled, productive, and safe workers for our state. The ability for us to indenture more apprentices, what we need as a training department is some less restrictions on the procedures, as well as when we do have cancellations, making sure that we don't go under sanctions. And I'll kind of step back a little bit. The construction industry, apprenticeship, is a very difficult industry. Okay. And it's no different than really going to college. Many people want to go to college, but, you know, college isn't for them. They fail or they don't want to go to college. Well, can you imagine going to work, not in this atmosphere, but outside where it's 30 degrees, it's raining, it's cold, you got to do work out there. You have to be productive. Well, some people, once they enter our programs, that's not what they want to do. It could be a nice summer day. But it's summer days at 80 degrees, no wind blowing. You know, at the same time, you're sweating so bad you can't see. If you wear glasses, you know, it's even more difficult. They just don't want to do the apprenticeship program anymore. So then they want to go someplace else. We have to cancel them. Our problem is that we can bring a lot of folks in. Problem is that we still want to graduate them and have them complete the program. But the industry itself sometimes dictates that people don't want to stay with our trades. So we would like a little bit maybe some less restrictions on the procedures as well as the cancellation numbers for us. Boley does work well with us, and they make sure that the training is performed with our program as well as many of the other programs in our state. You know, our apprenticeship program, just like many of the other building and construction trade programs, are privately funded. No public money is spent. This is actually a beautiful facility. We have one just up the road that we're going to spend upwards to $9 million on a training program. And it's from the members working, you know, every hour. The apprentices, there's an hourly amount that's set aside through collective bargaining that is earmarked strictly for training. Ours currently is around 55 cents per hour. For every hour that's worked by any carpenter, any millwright, pile driver, trade show worker, interior, exterior specialist, 55 cents every hour is paid into a training trust fund. That's what trains our apprentices. It also, after they leave our apprenticeship program, it trains our journeymen. You know, the technology is changing, you know, and we need those people to know what the technology is for the future. I think the best way for the apprenticeship to preserve the apprenticeship is to make sure that the state, you know, you don't have to spend any money in our apprenticeship programs, but mandate somehow that with publicly funded projects that there is apprenticeship hours in there. We want to make sure that our children get good education, they have colleges to go to. Apprenticeship is no different. When we have trained, skilled, productive workers out there, you heard today, you get five times the amount of money back that's spent in the training. Fund Bowley, they're doing a great job. We'll do our job training the folks out there. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I had one comment you made tweaks a question for me is then under public works jobs, whether they're city, county, or state, or federal, there's no allowance for within the wages paid there for a certain amount of the funds to flow to apprenticeship programs?
No, sir. There are, you know, prevailing wages. I heard you talk about it earlier today. But as far as set-asides for apprenticeship, there's nothing mandated in the state at this time. There are some stuff in the city of Portland that the city has mandated a certain amount of hours on projects to be set aside for apprenticeship, and I think that's what the state should do.
Any questions? I had the opportunity last fall to go down to Las Vegas and see the training center you have there to train the trainers, and it's a very impressive facility that your craft should be very proud of, and I'm sure you are.
Thank you, sir.
And I thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for being here.
Sir, I think this would be a good time for Ken Fry of the NEEC IBW Training Center and John Coolamore from the Area 1 Inside Electrical Training Center to come up.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Ken Fry. I'm the director of the NEEC IBW Electrical Training Center. I've had the opportunity to give some of you a tour of this facility, and we're very proud of what we have here. I also happen to serve on the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council, too, so I wear a couple of hats involved with apprenticeship. The main point that I wanted to make, and I'll be happy to give all of you or as many as you that want to go on a tour after your meeting today, and show you what industry can do when labor and management are working together for the common good of the industry. We're very proud of what we have here. This facility is 54,000 square feet, $6 million investment, and it's really an investment in the future of our industry and in the future of the state of Oregon. The people who complete this program will have living wage jobs until their retirement, and we're very proud of what we add to the economy. And it's kind of interesting talking about the community colleges earlier. I know that all the public entities are suffering with the reduced budgets, but heretofore we've had an agreement with Portland Community College, albeit fairly minimal. It was still an agreement where some of the FTE dollars found their way to our apprenticeship program. Well, as of the end of June, we will no longer have a contract with the community college. I don't believe Area 1 has a contract with any community college. Most of the apprenticeship programs are now operating outside the community college system, whereas over the years, all of us enjoyed a good relationship with the community colleges, and those no longer exist. I'm not lamenting that as much as I am just stating, you know, the the course of the future and what we're looking at as far as public funding of apprenticeship. Industry will step up to the plate. Industry will take care of our training needs, but it is a changing world. And I'd be happy to, after my counterpart here speaks, I'd be happy to answer any questions. So.
Chair Brown, and representatives. I'm John Coolamore with the Area 1 JATC, and we're the counterpart program. We have worked with Clackamas Community College in the past. About 15 years ago, we went together with the plumbers and built a building on their facility for the apprenticeship and training. This last year, we outgrew it and have broken out and actually bought the carpenter's old building and have moved into that to facilitate more space and more labs for our apprentices. We always strive hard to make sure that they get the proper training, and the colleges have worked with us halfway decent. As far as we seem like we pay them more than they pay us, but we're still trying to make sure that the guys get their proper training, and we've strove to expand our facilities and incorporate that into it. And a lot of that falls on the backs of the contractors and the apprentices themselves. They do pay for their education as they did at the college. That hasn't changed. The building is paid for by the contractors in our group. We don't have any outside income source besides the contractors and the people involved. So as a board, we have been fiscally responsible with our money and saved and was able to actually branch out and buy a building. It's been a slow process, but one that we're proud of. We've made big steps for a non-union, non-affiliated program as far as that, and the contractors have supported us greatly. And we put out a good product. Our guys have, done very well, and a lot of them have come back and become involved in the program as well. And we have a lot of people that sit on the board that have gone through the program and really worked hard to contribute back to the apprenticeship program. We have teachers who come back through full circle and re-instruct later on, and that's always good to see. And thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Anybody, any questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much for being here today. And committee, I very skillfully have guided this process back to we're right on time, 11 o'clock. I just a few closing comments. I think before we go on our field trip, I find myself the senior member of this committee in more ways than one. Not only am I the oldest by far, but I've also had the opportunity to serve the longest now in the legislature. And I have some fond memories and some bitter memories of the last two sessions and especially the five special sessions that I served through when we were trying very hard to rebalance our budget as our economy went in the tank and realizing that we're a state that is our revenue, we depend very heavily on an income tax to run all the programs that we have in the state. And you derive income tax when you got people working. And we didn't have people working then. And it's really rewarding and pleasing to see that our economy is turning around and that we are putting people back to work and that the construction industry is leading that recovery in the state. In the last session, Representative Gilman and I had the good fortune to serve on the Transportation Committee and work on a transportation package that the underlying focus was to, number one, to fix bridges around the state, and number two was to put people back to work in the state and do it through the construction industry. And it's very pleasing to see that you people in the trades are responding to that and getting people trained. And we have a challenge of 10 years ahead of us to complete those projects and to train the people to get that job done. And I thank you for that. And I really thank you for the opportunity of being here today, and thank you for everything you do for the state of Oregon, and it's greatly appreciated. Any other comments? Representative.
Chair, I was just a little mistaken. I thought that the main emphasis of the Transportation Committee last session was to make sure that people only went 20 miles an hour through school zones at 24 hours a day.
And we accomplished that, too. Anything else? Any other comments, committee? If not, we are adjourned.